Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. Climate negotiations in Baku, Azerbaijan, have reached a critical stage, but a resolution of the main sticking point, how much wealthier nations should pay poorer ones to help them respond to climate change, does not appear in sight. It's the early hours of Sunday morning there, and negotiators from the nearly 200 countries who signed up to the Paris Climate Treaty are still talking. It's not unusual for the annual conference of the parties, or COP as it's known, to go to the wire or even past it. Earlier, the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, caught up with some of the negotiators as they scuttled from room to room to try to get a sense of what's holding up a deal.
We're a day over the deadline for an agreement, and the representatives of dozens of the world's least developed countries have just stormed out of a key meeting. Cedric Schuster of Samoa represents the world's small island states.
We've just walked out. We came here to this COP for a fair deal. We feel that we haven't been heard, and there's a deal to be made, and we have not been consulted.
There is real anger here. Mohamed Adao speaks for African nations.
We need to hold the historic polluters accountable for the crisis they've caused, and we cannot let the great escape that they're actually planning in Baku. Baku will be remembered as the place that betrayed the world.
John, how's it going? Poor countries want more cash. Richer nations say they'll keep talking. John Podesta is the US's climate envoy.
I'm hoping this is the storm before the calm.
Are you confident that might be the case?
Well, we're going to keep working and see whether we can pull it back together.
But cash is hard to come by in developed countries like the UK, which face cost of living crises.
They're saying half a trillion minimum, or they won't do a deal. They're saying no deal is better than
a deal.
Well,
in the end, parties will have to decide the deal that is offered and whether it's an acceptable deal or not.
Currently, developed countries pay $100 billion a year. Energy Secretary Ed Miliband says the new offer of $300 billion by 2035 is generous, not when you take into account inflation, say poorer countries. Juan Carlos Gomez is the climate envoy for Panama.
This is what they always do. They break us at the last minute, you know. They push it and push it and push it until our negotiators leave, until we're tired, until we're delusional from not eating, from not sleeping.
And all the while, the clock keeps on ticking. The issue now is time. These talks have already overrun by a day and a half, and ministers have started to fly home. Now, decisions can only be made at these COP conferences with two-thirds of the delegates in the room. Unless an agreement can be made in the next few hours, these talks will collapse. That would be a huge blow to the global effort to tackle climate change. Countries need to make their carbon-cutting commitments for the next decade early next year. And without a finance deal, they're unlikely to be ambitious. And then, of course, in January, the US is likely to pull out of the process as Donald Trump returns to the White House.
That's the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlatt. Well, the state of the negotiations has been sufficiently serious for the president of COP29, Mukhtar Babayev, who is Azerbaijan's Minister of Ecology and Natural Resources, to plead publicly to the divided nations to step up their efforts to bridge the remaining divide. Live now to Baku and BBC Environment correspondent Matt McGrath. Matt, everybody had come back into the plenary session, the public area of these negotiations a few minutes ago. Things looked like they were moving and suddenly they were suspended again. What's happening?
Indeed, Sean, it's a real roller coaster here. As you heard in Justin's package there, things were looking extremely grim a few hours ago, but I think they've managed to pull it back from the brink. We're hearing and we're seeing that there's been some rough agreement on the new goal on finance. I've seen a couple of delegates go past me here giving a thumbs up as they did. Nothing's been done yet, nothing's gone through yet, but there's hope, I think, that some sort of deal can be done here and probably in the next hour or so.
And the positions were diametrically opposed at one point. It was basically the poorer countries saying you're not offering enough and the richer countries saying there's no more to offer.
Essentially, that's exactly right. And they put an offer on the table of $250 billion a year from 2035, nowhere near the ask from the developing countries of $1.3 trillion a year by the same date. There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. The developed, richer world have put that number up to $300 billion, and they've put a few other elements in there that they believe will help the developing countries accept the deal, which essentially are a roadmap to the 1.3 trillion number, a review along the way to ensure that the money goes up, and promises that essentially they will do better in the future. It's still not a done deal. There's a lot of dissatisfaction amongst developing countries, but they're getting to the point now where I think it's really take it or leave it.
And as we heard from Justin, if people start flying out, there's a danger of being below the number that would make a deal actually legally acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of people around here with their suitcases packed and ready to go. And I think people are just waiting for the nod. Now, whether the presidency have calculated this idea that, you know, they can push it as far as they can in terms of timing before people go and they'll get agreement that way, or whether it's just through incompetence, for a better word, I don't know. But there's certainly a lot of people ready to go. Everybody's in the plenary or getting ready to go into the plenary. That's the body that decides whether they'll accept the text or not. And I think there's a sense of hope that that will prevail and that we will see the finance issue resolved in the next hour, maybe two.
It's now gone 1 o'clock in the morning. I appreciate it's the middle of night to ask a question like this. But there was some kind of agreement on climate markets. Can you explain, as simply as you can, what that means?
Indeed, this has been a long-running sore issue in the negotiations here. It's part of the Paris Agreement. It's still not been agreed. They spent 10 years trying to work it out. And here in Baku, they managed to make some progress. That progress essentially would allow countries to cut their own carbon by buying emissions credits from other countries. It's very controversial, but there's been many years of discussions about it, and the COP has finally got to the position, I think, where they want to accept this and move on, because I think countries want to be able to do this, to cut their carbon by paying other people to essentially do it for them. As I say, controversial, but it could raise a lot of money, and that money could actually go and be part of the fund for developing countries that they're discussing here this evening.
Matt McGrath in Baku, Azerbaijan, thank you very much. We'll, of course, return there live if there are any developments in the course of NewsHour. Evans Njewa chairs the Least Developed Countries, or LDC, group made up of more than 40 nations which would receive money if there was a deal. When I asked him earlier about the walkout by members of his group and another representing island nations, his answer was diplomatic.
We did not necessarily walk out. But what we did was to just go for a timeout so that we can come out together and consult on a matter of urgency and importance. The process allows that if you have something to raise, you can go for that timeout and refresh your memories and go back into the room. And when we did that, the process continued.
Right, because the impression formed watching these developments was that it looked as though the negotiations were in danger of failing.
Not necessarily, but we are negotiating a number of agenda items, and the most important issue matter here is the climate financing, so that for the next coming years, maybe 5 years or 10 years, we have climate financing that is made available to the communities that are vulnerable in our countries to support their livelihoods and also contribute to poverty eradication. We just wanted to have a further look into it, and then so that we can come back with some better ideas.
Right now, is the proposal that the wealthier industrialized nations have made in terms of the amount of money they're prepared to offer you and other countries, is that offer enough at this stage?
As I speak now, we do not necessarily have an offer, because there was only one suggested figure, and this morning we're still looking into that figure, and when we reconvene, I think then we'll have a figure whose number I do not have now, but we hope it will be sufficient and good enough to meet our needs.
There has been pressure from among your member countries for the wealthier nations to provide funding amounting to $1 trillion a year. The richer countries say, after the financial situation, the effects of COVID, they simply can't afford it. Do you accept that argument?
I think we need to separate the two processes, like the COVID issue and other issues. But because this process is on climate change, which has some countries having responsibility and commitments, obligations to meet, and also, and therefore, I think the two processes should be separated.
You don't think that argument is appropriate?
No. I think, as I've said, the process has treaties that govern it. We have governing instruments, and therefore we just need to honor the obligations that we have in those treaties, because we have agreed to them and we have signed, we have ratified. We need to move together to address the goals that are enshrined in those treaties that we are saving.
Okay, you are back in the negotiations, you are talking, and the talks continue. But the president's statement earlier in the day talked about bridging a gap. So there clearly is a difference between the position of your group and the island nations group and that of the richer countries. In other words, they are not offering enough money. That is an accurate description of where we are at the moment.
No, I think we are yet to see. We will see what we take home. And because, as I've said, we just need to have a good figure that would save the people that are suffering, for example, in Malawi, when we have cyclones, when we have droughts in Zambia, in Nepal, like what happened 2-3 months ago. We lost lives, human lives, and then property from the climate-induced floods. What we want ultimately is for the least developed countries to all come out of poverty and then have good livelihoods like our colleagues are having.
And in terms of the timing then, you are prepared to carry on negotiating through the night if necessary. You still think it's worth trying?
Yes, it is, because the co-presidency must govern, and then he closes the conference, and then we get ready to go home.
You're not expecting to fly out tonight?
No, not tonight. I think colleagues that had their schedules for the night, they have left, but quite a good number of us are here, scheduled maybe to travel out on Sunday morning.
So you're waiting for a new figure? You're waiting for a new amount to be offered or to be put on the table?
Yes, just among a few things that are still remaining. We still have, I think, 3-4 agenda items to be concluded, and the figure is only one of them. There are some elements within that will travel together with the figure. We'll take that as a package together when we meet again.
That's Evans Ajewa, Chair of the Least Developed Countries LDC Group, talking to me just before we came on air. And whilst we've been on air, we've had this from Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister Biman Prasad. He's just told Reuters news agency, when it comes to money, it's always controversial, but we are expecting a deal tonight. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, we'll be hearing about how fans of mixed martial arts and its Ultimate Fighting Championship have been cultivated by Donald Trump and how it paid dividends in this month's US election.
Last year in 2023, Donald Trump appeared on a UFC's official podcast. They spent the entire hour just talking about boxing and MMA. Not one mention of politics, not a single mention of politics. Now you'd think, how is this beneficial to Trump?
Our headlines this hour: a deal on carbon markets has been reached at the UN climate summit in Baku, but there's still no agreement on the talk's key issue, how much compensation rich nations should pay to poorer countries, although hopes of a deal are rising. And a day of intense Israeli airstrikes and gun battles has left dozens dead in Lebanon. Last night, Scotland's oldest cello, having lain unplayed for 220 years, was heard in public once again in a performance in Aberdeen. The instrument, made there in the 1750s, belonged to James Beattie, Professor of Moral Philosophy at Marshall College in the city. Beattie was a distinguished public figure in his own right, once painted by the famous English artist Sir Joshua Reynolds for defeating the enemies of truth. But he was also a keen amateur musician. I've been speaking to Dr. Aaron McGregor, who lectures in music performance. He's a member of Scots Baroque, and also Lucia Capellaro, a fellow member of that group, who's a cellist and who played the Beattie instrument.
It's just stunning. It's very, very unique. It has a very kind of pure, warm and direct sound, which is very unusual. It's beautiful.
Is there any way, in its sense, in which it is different from other cellos?
Very much so. I would say that just in its design, the fact that it hasn't been touched for so long, it's in its original setup with tailpiece, fingerboard, everything. It means that the instrument feels untampered with. It's in its kind of natural state. And that means that everything about it, the way you pull the bow across the strings, everything about the touch under your fingers is completely different. So I basically just spent the last day trying to respond to it and learn it.
Dr. McGregor, tell us something about the owner of this instrument, James Beattie.
Well, he had very humble beginnings. He managed to go to Marshall College, which became the University of Aberdeen, very early as a student, as a teenager. He then later on became a professor of philosophy and became really one of the key Enlightenment figures in 18th century Scotland. So philosopher, famed poet, musician and writer on music, one of the first writers on aesthetics, and of course, a very vocal opponent of slavery, which is one of the reasons he's so well remembered today.
And that's the reason Joshua Reynolds painted him, yes?
Absolutely, yeah. It was after an essay which was kind of rebuking David Hume on his opinions on people from foreign nations, essentially.
Okay, do we know if he was any good as a musician?
He certainly was a very keen musician. He was a member
That's
of
a very diplomatic answer.
He wrote a lot about music. He, in his letters, he recounts lots of musical evenings he held at his home. And he also was a very keen member of the Aberdeen Musical Society, who held weekly concerts, brought up some of the best Italian musicians and had the first orchestra in Aberdeen in the 18th century.
Lucia, let me go back to you. What was the reaction of the audience when they heard the cello?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, I wasn't really paying attention on them. I was concentrating on the cello. No, I think they loved it. And especially some of the pieces that we played by Bocchi, who was an Italian living in Scotland, I think went down very well. They really gave the cello a chance to shine, and it felt like a very fitting piece to play as well.
So, Aaron, no, were you there?
I think they were thrilled.
I was performing as well. I'm also a violinist in the group. So,
did you have a chance to hear what you thought of it? Just last word.
I mean, I'm blown away by the instruments. You know, the instrument was of interest to me because of its historical importance. You know, it's the oldest Scottish cello and links to James Beattie. But what you don't necessarily expect is it's going to be absolutely beautiful. The theorba player in our group, Alex, said it's the best cello he's ever heard. Best cellist as well, of course. And it's such an open, warm, beautiful instrument. So that was a shock. A welcome shock.
Dr. Aaron McGregor and Lucia Cappellaro, both from Scots Baroque. Now, the discovery of a network of man-made canals in Central America is making archaeologists reassess how early civilization developed in what is now Belize. The earthen canals were used to catch fish. Until the discovery, based in part on surveys conducted using drones, the Maya people, whose descendants still live in Belize, were thought to be nomadic, at least until much later. Eleanor Harrison Buck, Professor of Anthropology at the University of New Hampshire in the United States, is co-author of the study, just published in the journal Science Advances. I asked her, what did we know about this area before the research was conducted?
What we know is that, of course, the Maya civilization was occupying this area beginning in the formative period, so around 1200, 1100 BC. But we realized that it's about 700 to 800 years after these large-scale fisheries were constructed. The period before the Maya civilization we describe as the Archaic period. What we think of is this period of mobile hunter fisher gatherer groups, a period that usually predates, right, this complex sedentary society in ancient Mesoamerica that we refer to as the Maya. That's how I would describe these two time periods that lead up to one another, this transition from the late Archaic to the formative Maya. We know very little about this transition, and so this is what's exciting about our research, I think.
So what was it you found, and how did you make this discovery?
Well, we identified the earliest late Archaic fish trapping facilities ever found in Central America, so it was quite exciting and unexpected. I should say that at least some of these linear features have been known about for some time. There's about a dozen of these long linear features that crisscross these wetlands in northern Belize were first noticed in some of the early satellite imagery over 2 decades ago by Ann Pyburn, an archaeologist who was working at a nearby ancient Maya site. Chowhish in this area. But it was, you know, in more recent years, of course, remote sensing technologies have really advanced significantly. So Google Earth satellite imagery and drones, they've really allowed some revolutionary discoveries within the Maya area. We've been able to identify now more than 160 of these long linear zigzag features that crisscross the wetlands.
In effect, are we talking about very early canals, man-made canals?
That's correct. Much earlier than we previously thought. They date to about 4,000 years ago. And we initially thought that they would have dated to the ancient Maya period, these massive constructions, because of the Maya were living right there in nearby city centers. But after running these 26 radiocarbon dates, it became clear they were built much earlier. So it was very exciting. And they were likely a large network of communities using these fish trapping facilities, probably seasonally at first. One of the things that we were able to determine when we started to look at the scale of these fisheries was that they probably could have supported as many as 15,000 people. And the other really important find is that the construction, the timing of the construction between really 2200 to 1900 BC is like a period often referred to as an extended drought period. So this is actually the timing of the construction for these may be not a coincidence, that they are corresponding perhaps as an adaptive strategy to this multi-centuries of drought.
Now, the fact that this network of canals exists, does that tell us that the civilization, the people that existed there before the Maya, were perhaps a bit more sophisticated than we'd previously thought?
I think it absolutely does. I think our assumption, you know, is that archaic hunter, fisher, gatherers were simple people living on the landscape and but not making much impact. And I think it tells us, otherwise, that that they were making large scale investments in the landscape and probably occupying this area intensively for millennia.
That's Professor Eleanor Harrison Buck of the University of New Hampshire on the Maya people in what is now modern-day Belize and the way they helped to shape their environment. Do stay with us here on BBC NewsHour. The head of the Norwegian Refugee Council has warned that after 19 months of war in Sudan, the country is disintegrating and there is a proliferation of armed groups. Jan Egeland has just returned from a visit to Sudan, where he's been speaking to our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
I'm just back from a week, both on the Red Sea coast in Port Sudan, in the east of Sudan, and in Darfur. And all that I saw confirms that this is indeed the biggest humanitarian emergency on our watch, the biggest hunger crisis, the biggest displacement crisis. Nowhere else in the world have 14 million people been driven out of their homes by senseless violence.
What more should be being done?
I think we have to call a spade a spade. The parties are tearing down their own house. They are massacring their own people. They are instrumentalizing starvation as a technique. But the rest of the world were also failing Sudan completely. It's an underfunded operation, even though it's the world's biggest emergency. The one big donor so far has been the United States. Number two, the aid agencies, many of the biggest agencies are not at scale in Sudan. We could all have done more. We can all do more. The biggest, many of the biggest non-governmental organizations are also not there. The parties are specializing in scaring us, and we're specializing in being scared. There should be much more pressure, diplomatic pressure from the UN member states, and we should also be probably showing more guts as humanitarian organizations.
And obviously, ending the war is what's really needed. Have you got any ideas that haven't been put forward yet as to how the fighting might stop?
Well, it would stop when these generals, when these warlords feel that they have more to lose by continuing fighting than by doing the only sensible thing, end the violence and start to talk. At this moment, it's not happening. There is not a concerted international pressure on the armed actors, and there are more and more disintegration, less unity of control, more armed men that are looting and going berserk on the civilian population. If Europe wants to avoid another 2015 with a million people crossing or more, they need to invest in aid and protection and peace in this corner of the world.
That's the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, who was speaking to the BBC's Africa regional editor, Will Ross, here on NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC, live from London. I'm Sean Lay. Now, Donald Trump announced a raft of names for his new administration on Friday. The most important was his nominee for Treasury Secretary. Scott Bessent, founder of the investment firm Key Square Capital Management, backed Mr. Trump last year, whilst many on Wall Street were still hedging their bets. In fact, Mr. Bessent, who years ago backed the Democrat Al Gore for president and was chief investment officer for the liberal philanthropist George Soros, apparently viewed Mr. Trump's headline-defying rise in the polls as like that of a financial investment, which rises despite bad news. In June of this year, Mr. Bessent spoke at the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute.
I think we are at a very unique moment here. Just in the U.S., I am alarmed by the size of these deficits and the spending. We do not have a tax collection problem. We have a spending problem. Number two, I think as an economic historian, I think we're also at a unique moment geopolitically. And I could see in the next few years that we are going to have some kind of a grand global economic reordering. There's a very good chance that we are going to have that over the next 4 years, and I'd like to be a part of it.
That's Scott Bessent talking in June of this year. Pete Rudiger of the Wall Street Journal covers hedge funds and investing. When I spoke to him earlier on Saturday, he told me more about Scott Bessent's political shift from supporting the Democrats to backing Donald Trump.
You know, his politics have kind of shifted over the years. He has given money to Democratic candidates. More recently, in the past 10 years, he's kind of drifted towards Republicans. He was a supporter of the president's in 2016. He thought a lot of people were underestimating Donald Trump's chances. This time around, I think he thought Trump was the best candidate to kind of accomplish what he thought we needed to accomplish economically in terms of trade, in terms of government spending and deficits. And as you noted earlier, he saw the kind of negative headlines around Trump not affecting his candidacy, reminding him of some investments he made that were unaffected by bad news. And seeing as he thought the president would win, he wanted to support him.
That was Pete Rudiger of the Wall Street Journal. Joining us live now is James Fishback, CEO of Azoria Partners, an American investment firm. He supports the proposal from the president that Mr. Bessent should be the new Treasury Secretary. Welcome to NewsHour, James Fishback. Why are you supporting him?
Well, Scott Bessent is, Sean, an America First fighter. President Trump has made another excellent choice. The reason why Scott is such a standout candidate for this role is because he's a successful macro investor. Think about what macro investing is. It's about anticipating what other global countries are going to do in response to geopolitical shifts and policies, and then designing your plan accordingly. And so when President Trump looks to explore the use of strategic tariffs to bring back manufacturing, to revive the economy here in the United States, Treasury Secretary Designate Bessent is the right person to help him anticipate how countries like China and Mexico are going to respond to those tariffs so we can have the best strategic plan on the books.
Previously, he'd described Mr. Trump's plan for tariffs on that scale as a maximalist negotiating strategy. Do you want a Treasury Secretary, given how important the role is, who is, as it were, prepared to speak truth to power? In other words, if he disagrees with President Trump, to give him candid advice?
Absolutely. I think open debate, substantive disagreement is important in these types of roles. But Scott Bessent and President Trump are on the same page that tariffs are a powerful negotiating tool to right the wrongs of the past 20 years, where other countries have massive trade deficits with the United States, where places like Middletown, Ohio, and parts of Appalachia are being hollowed out. Scott Bessent is a fighter for American workers and businesses. And again, President Trump has made another excellent choice.
You know him, I think. What would you say his qualities are for this job?
His quality, number one, is his ability to anticipate the second and third order effects of what a system might precipitate. So I'll give you an example. When he was a part of the team at Soros that ended up breaking the Bank of England, no offense to our friends across the pond, he was able to anticipate the way that interest rates were going to respond to those movements and then quite literally make $1 billion in a 24-hour period. And so I think you want somebody in that role who's a big picture thinker, who doesn't just think about the next chess move, but two, three, four chess moves down the line. That's why he's a perfect partner for President Trump's vision for what the economy will look like.
A week ago, Elon Musk was somewhat skeptical. He said on X, his social media platform, "My view is that Bessent is a business as usual choice." Why do you think he's wrong in thinking that?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, Sean, because I replied to Elon and disagreed with him and laid out the case for Scott. And Elon responded back to me and was open to it. And it looks like President Trump has, of course, taken the decision with Scott. I think that Elon has perhaps a different perspective on this than others. And I think that at the end of the day, with Howard Lutnick at Commerce and Scott Bessent at Treasury, President Trump will be served in both areas of the financial world to help deliver for the American people.
Is it possible that some of the more controversial nominations, I mean, the obvious one is Matt Gaetz, who was nominated for Attorney General but has now pulled out, were in a sense part of a negotiating strategy, but again, by the president to kind of put up a few people who senators might be a bit queasy about in order that they don't challenge some of the other names?
It's an interesting proposal to have thought of it that way. I think at the end of the day, President Trump is putting a good faith effort to putting some high quality candidates on the table. We've absolutely seen that. Brooke Rollins last night as agricultural secretary, of course, Elon and Vivek Ramaswamy as the head of the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. I think every one of these candidates should be immediately confirmed by the United States Senate. President Trump needs a cabinet on day one to deliver the historic mandate that Americans gave him on November 5th.
And do you think finally that he will be in a better position to govern this time, if he has this team, than maybe in his first term?
100%, Sean. 100%. There's no question that there were folks behind the scenes who openly and proudly bragged about trying to frustrate President Trump's efforts in the first term. What President Trump has done, he's assembled a cabinet of loyal people who are loyal not just to him. I think folks distort that loyalty point. They're loyal to the agenda of America First, of MAGA. President Trump has an A1 team, and he'll deliver with that team on January 20th.
James Fishback, CEO of Azoria Partners, thank you very much for talking to us here on BBC NewsHour. Now let's stay with the president-elect, because New York last Saturday night at Madison Square Garden, the Ultimate Fighting Championship promotional company held its latest event, a string of high-profile mixed martial arts bouts, or MMA for short. The biggest draw of the night, though, wasn't the fighters. The biggest draw was the US president-elect, Donald Trump.
45, soon to be 47, president-elect Donald Trump.
It's always loud when he comes here, but yes. Now that he's won, now that he's the president again, yes. Oh my God.
Well, MMA commentators there reflecting to the audience watching on TV the enthusiasm of the fans in the arena, many of whom are young men who voted Republican on the 5th of November. Mr. Trump walked into the event alongside the president of the UFC, Dana White, a man with whom he's cultivated a long and fruitful relationship. Karim Zidane is a journalist with the website Sports Politica, and I asked him to explain why there was such love for Donald Trump among fans of mixed martial arts.
The UFC itself began as a countercultural sort of niche violent sport, and it immediately gained sort of an affinity amongst these, you know, countercultural young men. Eventually, this sort of renegade approach to the organization, though it created this brand for the UFC, which was, you know, there are no rules, you know, there are no rules limiting you from, you know, doing whatever damage you want to your opponent. This caught the attention of people like John McCain, himself a boxing fan, mind you. So he was a fan of violent sports, to say, but he viewed mixed martial arts as absolutely barbaric and disgusting. He called it human cockfighting and basically started all this legislation and lobbying to get it banned across the United States. Eventually, it would get banned across 36 different states. Now, this was really this era of the organization being extremely ostracized. And what happened was, and this is part of the myth that appears thereafter, is that in 2001, the UFC had sold to new owners. And Dana White, the UFC president, was one of these new owners, along with two casino billionaires. Their very first UFC events, UFC 30 and 31, were held at the Trump Taj Mahal. Now, the way the UFC likes to tell this story now is that the Trump basically gave the organization their first shot. These are basically quotes from Dana White himself, because the UFC claimed that they were relegated to these other venues, that they couldn't actually get into really, you know, legitimate casinos and arenas like the Trump Taj Mahal. And that once they started hosting these events for Donald Trump, everything changed for the organization. Dana White eventually would go and speak for Donald Trump at the 2016 Republican National Convention. It was this bombastic speech where he basically said that Donald Trump is a fighter and I know he's going to fight for this country. And the reason he was saying that is because he believed that Donald Trump has this incredible business savvy, that he was able to discover the UFC at a time where everybody hated the sport, and that he can basically do the same for America. And because Trump himself came into politics with this approach of, you know, let's drain the swamp, let's be different to other politicians, it really matched the UFC's own bombastic countercultural approach, which caught the attention of the fan base, which has slowly gone more and more conservative over the past few years. In the decade alone that I've been reporting on this sport, I've watched a massive transformation of the fandom. This was a sport that was once diverse. The UFC itself used to have t-shirts called We Are All Fighters, which they used to promote during Pride Month. They actually promoted LGBTQ plus values. You will not see those shirts in existence anymore.
I was going to ask you, is there a crossover between the demographic profile of the current fan base of mixed martial arts and Donald Trump supporters?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was really evident in this recent election in November. So what we have here is a UFC fan base now that's primarily made up of young men, but not just any young men. It's either conservative men, or better yet, what the UFC really holds on to is this apathetic, apolitical base.
Arguably also a part of the electorate that has been very difficult for any politician to reach, still less to get to the polls.
This is absolutely true. The thing is that people spend the past couple of years actually making fun of Donald Trump's strategy of targeting young men, this so-called low propensity votership, right? So the truth is that it was an actually incredibly intelligent decision, and it was one that was facilitated by the UFC. Part of Donald Trump's campaign communication staff is a man named Stephen Chung, who actually used to be the UFC's own communications director. The podcast that Donald Trump appeared on, from the Nelk Boys to Theo Vaughn, was also facilitated by the UFC president himself, Dana White. I'll give you one great example. Last year, in 2023, Donald Trump appeared on a UFC's official podcast. It's called UFC Unfiltered. They spent the entire hour just talking about boxing and MMA. Not one mention of politics. Not a single mention of politics. Now, you'd think, how is this beneficial to Trump? Actually, when you look at the comments from that podcast on YouTube and elsewhere and on social media, you'll see that he actually resonated with the audience. A lot of people would say, you know, I never cared for his politics, but he might be the only person in DC who I can sit down and have a beer with.
That's Karim Zidane from the website Sports Politica. He was talking to NewsHour on the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. A reminder of our top story on NewsHour. The UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, has reached an agreement on global carbon markets, but there's been a fierce dispute over how much money richer nations should offer poorer countries to help them tackle climate change. The talks have overrun, but they're still going. Speaking to this programme, the BBC's environment correspondent Matt McGrath said delegates were cautiously optimistic.
We're hearing and we're seeing that there's been some rough agreement on the new goal on finance. I've seen a couple of delegates go past me here giving a thumbs up as they did. Nothing's been done yet, nothing's gone through yet, but there's hope, I think, that some sort of deal can be done here and probably in the next hour or so.
One other headline, Lebanon has seen a day of intense airstrikes and fighting across the country. At least 35 people were killed in Israeli attacks. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. To Germany now, which will hold early elections in February after the collapse of the governing coalition, currently led by the centre-left Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Opinion polls suggest he's likely to lose the election to Friedrich Merz of the centre-right CDU. In 2015, Germany welcomed hundreds of thousands of refugees from the civil war in Syria. In 2022, more than 1 million Ukrainians who were fleeing Russia's attempted invasion. But as Nick Robinson reports from Berlin, attitudes now are much changed.
I'm standing in Berlin's central train station, where I stood 2.5 years ago, watching trains arrive, packed full of refugees, watching hundreds of ordinary Germans volunteering to hand out free train tickets to their next destination. Free food and clothes, toys for the children.
This is our welcome hall. Since some people need to stay overnight, we do have some children beds over there.
Ever since Germany opened its doors to 1 million Ukrainians to come to this country, to enter German homes, the mood here towards migration has been shifting. And the election that's going to be held in this country in just 14 weeks' time is very likely to elect a government with a very, very different attitude.
Eingefahrene Zug auf Gleis 16, S9 nach Charlottenburg, über Zoologischer Garten.
Go to the main stations here. You don't feel safe. During the day, from 6 in the morning to 3, 4 o'clock in the night, you see the people, you know, African people, Syrian people, dealing, obviously. And you feel somehow police has lost control, and this is not a good development. I don't like that at all. We need to get back control.
I've come to a cafe in a prosperous district of West Berlin, Charlottenburg, to talk to Michael Wasilek. He's a businessman here, a voter for the CDU, the Christian Democrats, a man who once embraced the values, the attitudes of Chancellor Angela Merkel, but now speaks of a very different approach.
Too many of refugees is not good for a country, I don't think. It's not good for the values of the country. And people feel overwhelmed by foreigners, and that feeling just can't be put aside, you know. It's just there.
Discourses have changed and racist positions are normalized now.
Dr. Sabine Speiser, who's on the board of Berlin's Refugee Council, wishes that attitudes now were anything like they used to be just a few short years ago.
So you can easily say, okay, we have too many of them here. They better should go home. That was not possible to say like that in, let's say, like 2 or 3 years ago. Laws are already being changed. Narratives are already broadly changed. Things which have not been pronounced, certain positions, publicly, you can read them in nearly every newspaper.
It was at another train station, the station in Munich, after the start of another war, the war in Syria, when 9 years ago, Germany showed that it was determined to say welcome to refugees from around the world.
People are applauding the refugees as they arrive. They're here, this is their final destination. ordinary German men and women stood here and applauding them. Welcome to Germany. How do you feel? Thumbs up. And there's a little boy here handing out sweets to children.
The former German ambassador to the UK, Thomas Matusek, remembers how that moment made many Germans feel.
When we saw the enormous influx, it was not that the German public opinion said, oh God, what's happening here? No, they said, we are delighted. Come to us. And people were greeting them at the border. They had toys for children, etc. And to be quite frank, the Germans felt very good about it, because it's such a cozy feeling that all of a sudden, Germany is a country where people are nice, we have open arms, etc.
The mother of the nation, Mutti Merkel, as she was often called, reassured Germans that...
Wir schaffen das. Wir schaffen das. Und wo uns etwas im Wege steht...
She said, wir schaffen das. We can do it. This was interpreted by people, well, the Germans can do it, everybody can come.
Ich hätte gerne einen Kaffee, ein Croissant, bitte.
Back in the cafe, Sabine mulls on how much has changed since then.
We had great times of manifestations and demonstrations. We had many people on the streets.
Michael once backed Merkel's approach, but now thinks it has to change.
We have lost our values a little bit, in my point of view. You know, I was very pro Angela Merkel when she invited everybody to come here. And I think in Germany, as well as the UK, I guess, we need immigration. But let's have a controlled immigration. We have all the Ukrainians coming here. When the war started, my wife and myself, we had three families living with us, just women, you know. So I think that's a good thing. But people want to be here. People want to learn the language. People want to work. So help them doing this. And there sometimes we are standing ourselves in the way.
Aber auch unser Land steht in diesen Wochen und Monaten vor einer ganzen Reihe von...
The man who everyone assumes is Germany's next chancellor is Friedrich Merz. He's from the same Christian Democrat party as Merkel, but has a very different approach to migration. He wants to close Germany's borders to refugees and talks of a threat to the country's Leitkultur. What does that mean?
Well, Leitkultur is not a very sharply defined idiom.
Former German ambassador to Britain, Thomas Matusek again.
What Merz, I suppose, means is that people who come here from a different cultural background should at least try to adapt to the way we live here. That means, for instance, that you shake hands, or that you let your children go to school, and things, or that your wife can work and can move outside the home.
Germany's mainstream politicians are having to respond to the shift in public attitudes, to the rise of the far right, the alternative for Deutschland, the AfD. The next few weeks will demonstrate the direction in which Germany is heading. At the moment, it appears to be a much tougher attitude to migration, a much harder attitude to refugees.
That's Nick Robinson reporting from the German capital, Berlin, on the prospects for the forthcoming federal election and the prospects of immigration playing a big part. Thanks for your company on NewsHour.